Good evening. It's a great pleasure to welcome you to the Campaign Against Arms Trade's second annual lecture, and a particular pleasure to welcome you to this hall with its tradition of discussion and debate. My name is Janet Williamson, and I'm a former Campaign Against Arms Trade staff member and now a member of its steering committee, and I'm chairing tonight's lecture. Can I please start by asking all of you to turn off any mobile phones and pages that might possibly be switched on? Many of you will be familiar with the work of the Campaign Against Arms Trade, or CAT as it is known, but for those who are not, I'll say just a few words. CAT is a coalition of groups and individuals working for an end to the international arms trade. We campaign in particular for an end to sales to repressive regimes and to areas of political tension, and for an end to all government subsidies for the trade. At the back of your programme is a form that you can fill in for more information about the campaign, and I'd urge you to fill this in and hand it in at the end of the lecture. We are very fortunate indeed to have for our speaker tonight Sir Samuel Britton. As many of you will know, Samuel Britton has been a highly respected columnist at the Financial Times for many years. He is the author of a number of books, including most recently Capitalism with a Human Face and Essays, Moral, Political and Economic, very relevant thesis for this tonight's lecture. As well as his FT column, he's written articles for a wide range of publications over the years and was knighted in 1993 for his services to economic journalism. His work has won him a number of prestigious awards, and he's an Honorary Fellow of Jesus College, Cambridge, an Honorary Doctor of Letters at Edinburgh, and an Honorary Doctor of Essex University. Cat's ears pricked up, if you'll forgive the expression, when Samuel Britton started to write about the arms trade in his FT columns. For us, it was a significant milestone that concerns about the economics of the arms trade had made it onto the pages of the Financial Times. Sir Samuel, we're very grateful to you for agreeing to speak to us this evening, and looking forward very much indeed to hearing what you have to say. Sir Samuel Britton.
Thank you very much for your kind introduction, which I don't deserve, but I'm grateful all the same. It is a privilege both to give the annual lecture of the Campaign Against the Arms Trade and to speak in this great hall. Having heard so many Nobel Prize winners speaking here, I find it rather daunting. But it's not only because of the hall. This is not because of any doubts about my case, but because I have known that I would be talking to several different audiences at the same time. There are many people here from the campaign who do not need to be told of the arguments against selling arms to dubious regimes, but who mainly want to know the most effective answer to give to people who fear that the British economy would collapse without such sales, or more moderately, that there would be a big loss of jobs and exports, leading to a balance of payments crisis and a run on sterling. There may, on the other hand, be people who have come in response to the open invitation, who need to be convinced about the fundamental arguments, because they fear that a gesture by Britain alone would be futile and achieve nothing. Finally, there may be people who support what the government has already done to clamp down on undesirable arms exports, and what it is planning to do in the not quite hypothetical event of it winning the next election. Now, while I am more than happy to give praise where praise is due, this section of my audience, the On Message section, might like to know what remains still to be done. And what the gaps are in the government's implementation of its pledge to implement a foreign policy with an ethical element. This is a highly desirable ambition which does not deserve the sneers it sometimes receives. And even those who are more impressed by the shortcomings than the achievements should remember a famous definition of hypocrisy. It is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. But virtue needs to be defined a bit and defended. Let me make my own position clear. I am against any kind of subsidy open or concealed, for exports of weapons or military aircraft. I would also like to see much firmer measures against the export of small arms, even when there is no element, or only a small element, of subsidy involved. Those who accept the thesis do not have to agree on exactly which regimes are the most dubious. There's a pretty clear basic list of regimes that commit aggression, support terrorism, or oppress large bodies of their own citizens. We can argue about how far the list should extend. Indeed, if any of you have wandered in from the economics faculty, first thing I'd like to say is you haven't had very far to come. The next thing is that you might like to note that I'm in fact against most of what is called the export drive. The attitude of many market-inclined economists, including many in government departments to this viewpoint, is to say that this is all very fine, but stands no chance of being adopted by any political party. And they then usually send me a paper suggesting some marginal improvements, and even these have great difficulty in getting through. But we need to advance slowly here, as in many other areas. The place to make a start with the elimination of export subsidies is surely the sales of weapons and military aircraft, which have detrimental effects on third world development, which aggravate conflict, and which, extraordinarily enough, end up being used against British and other international forces. My position is pacific rather than pacifist. So long as Britain has armed forces, and so long as the country belongs to NATO or any other alliance, it surely makes sense to engage in international trade rather than aim for self-sufficiency. In the latest financial year, the Ministry of Defence spent 13% of its equipment budget on 64 cooperative equipment programmes involving 19 partner nations. The most important of these by far were, in order, France, Germany, the USA, Italy and the Netherlands. The number and proportion are expected to rise. Indeed, it would be difficult to argue that each of these allies should be completely self-sufficient in arms production, with all the wastes that this would involve. In fact, we need more specialisation in arms productions among NATO countries and other allies rather than less. Such specialisation should bring many of the economies of scale which supporters of the wider arms trade think can only come through the export of weapons and military aircraft to Saudi Arabia and other dubious areas. Now, having said this, I must pay a tribute again to the Campaign Against the Arms Trade and other non-governmental organizations. They may be a few steps ahead of even radical public opinion, but the result of their zeal has been an expertise in the area and a depth of investigative analysis which it is difficult to find elsewhere. Indeed, much of the factual material which I'm using in this lecture and in more detailed written expositions comes from their investigations. Now, there is sometimes a conflict between national self-interest and ethical actions, just as there can be a conflict between personal self-interest and moral behavior. But in both cases, this is often exaggerated. In the national case, it is exaggerated by an inflated view of the role of arms and export promotion in the British economy. The promotion and de facto subsidization of arms sales is, like most other industrial subsidies, wealth destroying. And there would be very little, if any, sacrifice involved in doing away with the whole effort. Behind the arms promotion lobby is the primitive belief that if one source of overseas sales dries up, the workers and other resources involved would simply waste away. This is rubbish in view of the millions of people who change jobs every year. If other countries want to compete with us in foolish subsidies, let them. Subsidized credit for exports of arms or major capital goods have far worse effects than the merely economic ones. Western nations are undoubtedly rich enough to waste some resources. As Adam Smith said, there is an awful lot of ruin in a nation. The worst effects are political and moral. They are both illustrated by the instance of the Pergau Dam in Malaysia in the mid-1990s, when a conservative government overturned a publicly minuted reservation by the permanent secretary of the Department of Overseas Development and insisted on supporting credits for this dam. Now, one of the unstated arguments for going ahead was that this would act as a sweetener to persuade the Malaysian government to buy other goods, including arms, from Britain. On the other hand, arms sales are justified because they are supposed to persuade governments that buy them to use British equipment in their capital projects. Thus, one bad consequence is called in aid to support another, and third world despots are encouraged to devote still more resources to military spending or to prestige projects of dubious value. More recently, a Labour Prime Minister was said to have overruled the Foreign Secretary when he authorised a statement by Stephen Byers on the December the 21st, 1999, that he was minded, subject to certain conditions, to grant export credit for the Ilisu Dam project in Turkey, which will flood several valleys with sites of unique cultural and religious value to the Kurds. You can imagine what this will do to promote harmony inside Turkey. In the spring of 2001, we are still waiting for a decision. It may be some rumor that I was going to say something like this that accounted for the story in The Guardian that Stephen Byers was going to come here. I wish he would. He might learn something. Now, we cannot leave out of account the enormous part that corruption plays in the arms and related trades. A forthcoming study by Joe Rober concludes that because of the structure, complexity, and capacity of the market, and above all because of the secrecy that surrounds every aspect of its activities, the international arms trade is the most corrupt of all legal trades, and some illegal ones too. He finally asks, can we justify bribing people to buy arms they may not need with money their taxpayers cannot afford simply to inflate the number of jobs in a declining industry? Now, all these follies are supported by the myth that exports are valuable for their own sake, however small the return the British nation gets from them. Business lobbyists are able to persuade a succession of prime ministers, ranging from ultra-dry conservatives to New Labour, that if the government does not support them, their overseas rivals will win the contracts instead. I wish we had a prime minister with analytical resilience simply to reply, let them. We should follow the example of General de Gaulle. He may not be the most popular person in this room, but when he was told that if the French left Algeria, the Russians would take their place, his reply was curt, I wish them much joy of it. The same applies to the UK or other governments that want to throw away their national resources on projects which not only do not pay domestically, but which are detrimental to genuine third world development. Now, in July 1997, the then new Foreign Secretary, Robin Cook, stated that the government would not permit the sale of arms to regimes that might use them for internal repression. This was, of course, in the wake of the Arms for Iraq scandal. In fact, the present government has gone further than either its predecessors or the governments of many other countries in fulfilling this pledge. The third annual report on UK strategic export controls has been described by Safer World as the most transparent of any European country. But there is still a long way to go. A joint report of four parliamentary committees pointed to a serious error of judgment in granting export licenses for military equipment to the government of Zimbabwe. And there are other examples involving, for instance, Indonesia and China. Apparently, Britain is still selling military aircraft to India, despite that country's nuclear tests. The only reason why there are no such sales to Pakistan is because of the military coup there. Yet the Indian subcontinent is probably the part of the world most subject to the risk of nuclear conflagration. Its only rival, perhaps, being the Middle East. Now, at the time of the East Timor crisis in early 1999, there appeared a telling Times cartoon. On one side, there was a buoyant Tony Blair, and he was shown exclaiming, "We need a hawk." That meant a more determined military effort to put pressure on the government of Indonesia. That's fine. But on the other side, he was shown piloting one of the hawk aircraft that Britain had been delivering to Indonesia for many years for use on the country's former military dictator, General Suharto. Now, the official estimate for British arms sales is that they amounted in 1999 to about 4 billion per annum, or appreciably less than 0.5% of the national income. Now, I think this is a good chance to give you a rest from my voice and show and put on slide one, which I think will show the development of arms. Now, as you see, 1999 was a rather from the point of view of arms trade, is a rather disappointing year. 1996 and 97 were much larger. The trend is unfortunately gradually upwards, although with a lot of dips and high places. And perhaps we might also have a look at chart two, which, if we are lucky, will show where the arms went. Now, this is the average for 1995-99. This actually shows what they were. And you will see the vast majority were military aerospace. And these are concentrated in one or two firms, which I'm afraid have very good access to Whitehall, as they say, at the highest level. Also, and this may not be on any of the charts, but I think we can finish with this now, but there is also a disproportionate amount of the arms go to the Middle East. 1999 was a bad year for deliveries to Saudi Arabia, which is perhaps why there was a dip in that year, but usually the Middle East accounts for a good third of arms sales. Now, the most an academic estimate of the cost of government support has been about £200 million per annum. But indirect support of what is known euphemistically as the defence industrial base is many times larger. The most important direct support comes from the Export Credit Guarantee Department, ECGD, which ensures and finances exports of capital goods. A former senior Treasury official has publicly said that this department is too vulnerable to intensive lobbying by large corporations through their ministerial contacts. The most dangerous military exports, which attract only indirect subsidies, are, however, those for small arms used for domestic repression. According to Claire Short's recent white paper, of the poorest 40 countries in the world, 24 have recently been in the midst of armed conflict, mostly in Africa. The British government would undoubtedly like to curb this trade and subscribes to international agreements for this purpose. The Scott report advocated legislation to put control on arms exports and arms brokering, even more important, onto a permanent, non-emergency basis. Legislation has long been delayed, but it has last been promised for the next Parliament, and this is undoubtedly a step forward. But the government is still inhibited by two factors: its reluctance to move ahead of competitor countries, and its belief that such arms can legitimately be sent to official governments as distinct from so-called rebels. Finally, there is the very obscure Ali Imama deal with Saudi Arabia, under which weapons are exchanged for oil. Exports to Saudi Arabia, as I mentioned before, have accounted in many years for about a third or more of British overseas arms sales. There is no sign of the government wanting to terminate this agreement, and smoke screens from Whitehall suggests we're in the interval between one Ali Imama agreement and another. I should add that everything I know about the Ali Imama agreement comes from assiduous research by this campaign, derived mainly from official documents and company reports, but it requires a great deal of zeal, and I'm most grateful to CAT for having unearthed a great deal of information on this. They've got a pamphlet on it, and in a longer piece of mine I summarise it. Now, a popular view is that some arms sales may be undesirable, but that they can help promote jobs, growth and employment. Therefore, a balance has to be drawn between these two considerations. A compromise always appeals to the so-called practical man. We will thus never really stop dubious arms sales until the myth of the export drive is nailed once and for all. The root of the matter is the belief throughout the political and business establishment that exports are worthwhile for their own sake, irrespective of the terms on which they are sold and how much they have to be subsidized. It is for this reason that prime ministers, whether Thatcher, Major or Blair, time and again come down against the Treasury in favor of controversial arms deals or dubious overseas capital projects. Now, the balance of payments preoccupation goes back many centuries. Mercantilist writers in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries campaigned for a favorable balance of trade and for an inflow of gold and silver. These writers were refuted as conclusively as anything can be in political economy by 18th century members of the Scottish Enlightenment, such as David Hume and Adam Smith. And during the period of rapid world economic growth towards the end of the 19th century, huge current account surpluses and deficits built up as the other side of the flow of savings to capital-hungry developing countries. These deficits and surpluses were far higher than any of the so-called imbalances which speech writers have so bemoaned in recent years. The origin of both the export drive and the reinvention of the so-called balance of payments problem was in the immediate post-war years, when sterling was on a fixed exchange rate and was also inconvertible. The financial policy regime was then one of suppressed inflation. It was held down by a mixture of controls and exchange rate overvaluation. It was, moreover, a world with strict controls over capital flows. These controls could never be severe enough to protect determined speculators from launching an attack on a suspect currency, as Cripps himself discovered. But they were a deterrent to the regular flow of capital across borders, which normally finances imbalances on capital account, on current account. The post-World War II generation of political and economic leaders was brought up on slogans and posters such as export or die, the dollar drive, and even on one occasion, exporting is fun. I might tell you afterwards the story behind that slogan, which annoyed very much the people at the sharp end. By contrast, we are now back in a world of relatively free capital flows. There are bound to be large imbalances between countries with high savings ratios and relatively few investment outlets, and other countries, such as the United States, which at least until recently have had low savings but many investment opportunities. Moreover, we now have floating exchange rates. And advanced industrial countries with floating exchange rates need never have balance of payments problems. They may suffer from unwelcome downward pressure on their exchange rates due to financial markets' distrust of their policies or of fears about domestic inflation. If so, such fears should be tackled directly. The export drive is a hangover from the siege economy days of Stafford Cripps. Might remind you, was Labour Chancellor in the late 1940s. They have no place in a global market economy. In practice, it amounts to the diversion of public resources towards special interest groups under the guise of patriotic slogans. The basic political and business fallacy is not to realize that exports, like investment, are a cost and not a benefit. If we could finance the imports that the British citizens want to buy without any exports, say by interest-free flows and interest-free loans from overseas on indefinite repayment terms, we would be better off. Of course, this would require a period of adjustment in the export trades, but such adjustments are necessary after any kind of economic or industrial change. In the world as it is, exports are a waste of resources and serve no purpose if they are not paid for, or if they're paid for very late and on a heavily subsidized credit basis and with a strong political risk factor. Now, the most popular argument for subsidizing exports is, of course, the effect on jobs. We should be on our guard when politicians defend dubious policies by saying jobs are at stake. This is so whether it is an old Labour supporter wanting to protect manufacturing, a Tory spokesman talking about the employment provided by hunting, or a business lobbyist pushing for arms sales to dubious regimes. These people may seem to have very different political colours. To the economic analyst, they are old, slightly different varieties of hedgehog. Prickly and unpleasant. Now, the argument that jobs derived from exporting weapons cannot be replaced is akin to the argument for keeping open uneconomic coal mines for the sake of employment. Yet it is often just those people who lecture us on the need for workers to change jobs and who say that full employment cannot mean the same employment. It's just these people who are most keen to promote the sale of arms. Now, such arguments are based on the myth that there is a lump of labour that is engaged in making specific products. Then it is supposed, if orders or output are lost in one area, they cannot be regained anywhere else. But people change jobs constantly. Well over 3 million people leave the unemployment register each year, even in recession periods. Over half of them for new jobs or training. Indeed, it is almost certainly easier for arms workers, many of whom have a wide range of valued skills, to find new jobs than it was for miners, whose training was far more specific. One of the key ideas of economics is that of the circular flow of income. The point is that there's a continuing flow between purchasers who desire to buy products, the incomes received from supplying their needs, and still further purchases. The idea is so basic that economists regard it as too obvious to mention. They take it for granted rather than discuss it explicitly, and then they rush on to their equations. Now, the smoothness of this flow can be helped by sensible policies, such as the efforts by the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee to maintain an adequate but not excessive flow of total spending, and by sensible exchange rate policies. The interested citizen needs to know mainly that there is or can be such a circular flow, and that there therefore need be no fear of one country being undercut in everything by another. Unfortunately, most public discussion is dominated by the very opposite idea, the myth of irreplaceable sectors. For instance, it is assumed that if Britain loses arms orders in pursuit of a foreign policy with an ethical element, that the displaced workers in the arms industry will simply waste away in idleness. It is not asked whether there will be other purchasers at home or abroad to make up the difference. A further argument relates to small exports. who might not have the resources to engage in the required market research and export promotion. But surely this kind of thing is a job of market research institutes and advertising agencies, chambers of commerce and industry associations. If it does not pay them to engage in such promotion, it is because government support agencies are providing these services on a free or subsidized basis. Now, the last resort of any sector or industry whose subsidies are challenged is to say it brings spillover benefits to the rest of the economy. Concord was virtually launched on such arguments, and it has carried on costing the Treasury an awful lot. Weapons producers argue that the government should continue to support exports because the proceeds contribute to the overhead costs of firms supplying the military. But if you look at it in more detail, these considerations cut both ways. The drive for arms sales itself distorts the design and production plans of British manufacturers. And in the view of some defence economists, these offset any savings in overheads. In any case, only some arms exports would be affected by a ban in the spirit of a supposedly ethical foreign policy. The posited economies of scale could be readily achieved by greater specialization among EU or NATO countries, a process still inhibited by the desire of so many governments to protect domestic firms. I've seen estimates ranging up to £4 billion per annum, which could be saved either from buying that from NATO countries or EU countries, either buying arms from the cheapest market within these alliances, or setting up a single international procurement agency. Now, many of the issues I've discussed are highlighted by a report on export credit by the National Economic Research Associates, called NERA for short. There has been some misguided celebration of the fact that NERA did not recommend that ECGD should be privatized. But a much more important question is whether the provision of insurance cover should be subsidized. Until 1991, ECGD showed heavy cash flow losses. It was then instructed to break even in cash flow terms, in line with Berne procedures. But the ECGD is still not required to show the positive return in real terms required on public sector investment projects. NERA could not find any justification for the implicit subsidy. A most important finding which the vested interests involved have contrived to bury. Much more important than any of these details is that reports such as NERA's are based on a mutually convenient misunderstanding. Economic research organizations trying to unearth the case for intervention and subsidy, which they need to do if they're to get contracts, tend to focus on lapses from perfection inherent in almost all markets. Matters such as informational barriers facing potential new exporters, and which governments might help, be able to help overcome by activities such as trade fairs or start-up credits. NERA, of course, found such imperfections. Politicians and opinion leaders, however, take such reports as confirmation that without export promotion, the balance of payments would go haywire, the country would become bankrupt, and thousands of jobs would be lost. They conveniently overlook the fact that these bankruptcy and job fears are dismissed in polite terms by bodies such as NERA as fallacies not worth serious consideration. NERA, for instance, remarked that the last thing the overheated British economy needed was extra demand for labour. Even if there is now a risk of recession, selective aid to a few heavy goods or arms manufacturers would be an extremely inefficient way of stimulating demand. Now, many critics argue that a cut of one-third would effectively eliminate the most dubious arms sales. Let us suppose, then, that British arms exports were cut by $1 billion or $2 billion a year. Let us grant that these exports would have to be replaced or imports reduced in their stead. But there is no more a fixed lump of exports than there is a fixed lump of jobs. In fact, the arithmetic is far too generous to the arms lobbies. It would apply if we were talking about an industry that does not get special government help. In that case, the resources involved would have to move to their next best use. But arms sales do not represent, even in the narrowest economic terms, the best use of national resources. They are so heavily supported by the taxpayer that they might actually be a gain in moving the workers' plant and technical skill to other activities that could pay for themselves. Let me cite two related bottom-up industry studies. These have examined the impact of a one-third reduction in arms exports based on the average of the decade 1985 to 95. The output of weapons and ammunition would have been cut by about 12% and of aero exports by 9%. This is a good opportunity to put the last slide on. Now, without my repeating all the figures, for once this slide is large enough to be seen, it's pretty obvious that defense spending is a pretty small fraction of total employment. Employment for military exports is a small fraction of that, and the number of jobs lost with a third reduction in exports would amount to over 30,000, a very small decimal fraction of 1%. Either of GDP or exports. Now, in fact, I'll tell you a secret. I originally wanted this to be a pie chart, but the 30,000 was so small as a proportion of total employment that the machine could not draw it. There were techniques that could be used before we had these machines, but they are not available to so-called intelligent machines. Now, at the time this study was made, the maximum number of jobs lost would have been not 30,000, but 40,000. On the basis of labor turnover estimates, the author estimated that 40% would have found New York, 40% of 40,000 would have found New York new work within a year, and another 13% in the year after that. 27% would have taken more than 2 years to find a new job, and some 20% would have left the labor force. The impact would have been greatest where defense employment is concentrated in one or two plants in individual towns, such as Bristol, Plymouth, Yeovil, and Preston. The hypothetical one-third cut in arms exports would have initially reduced total exports of all goods and services by about 0.5%. Nearly half of this half would have been replaced alternative exports produced by redundant workers finding work within the year. The remainder could be found partly from those finding work later and partly through shifts within and between industries. We are talking about the loss of 0.25% of UK exports of goods and services. But let us again, for the sake of these famous members of the economics faculty, if they're here, this might involve a minuscule devaluation and some slight adjustment in monetary and fiscal policy. If we cut through the technicalities, the cost could be a tiny deterioration in the terms of exchange between British exports and imports from overseas. The academic authors did search for some positive overall overspill benefits from promoting military exports to offset against the costs. The largest they can find is the contribution of exports, as I mentioned before, to the overhead costs of firms which serve the home market as well. The second largest came from the contribution of exports to development costs. Against these modest industrial costs have to be set notable government budgetary savings. That's making the cut. The government has to take into account in its policies not only value for money, but supposed industrial and employment benefits in placing military orders. For example, in 1995, a recommendation by the Equipment Approvals Committee in favor of the American-designed Chinook helicopter was overridden by the Secretary of State for Defense in favor of a mixed order involving Westland. I once thought that these helicopters were flying through my living room. Netting all these estimates out, the defense economists arrive at an annual gain of £76 million for the Exchequer from the postulated cut in arms sales. One does not have to pretend that these estimates are precise or that the cost saving is enormous. The thrust of the argument is that the net effect on the British economy of reducing arms sales are negligible or even favourable. Interestingly enough, similar results have been emerging in France. A committee of the French National Assembly was given an analysis of 21 of 42 programs of French arms exports, which were said to have reduced purchasing prices for the French armed forces. The conclusion was that for half of these, the gains of scale were countered by various factors, such as changes in specifications and delays, which I already mentioned in the British context. For the other half, the scale effect did not lead to any reduction in the prices paid by the French government, because the profit from the extended production lines went to the companies. And would it be lowering the tone of this lecture hall too much if one reminded people of the exchange of personnel in all countries between departments of defense and companies engaged in selling them weapons? Now, the favorite business argument, which one hears particularly, but not only in relation to arms sales, is that if the British government does not produce them, the American, French, or Chinese, or other governments will, leaving Britain, as usual, the mug. I'm all for international disarmament treaties. But supposing, and we have mentioned a few, but supposing that other countries do not go all the way. It is like saying that you should not stop knocking your head against a brick wall until your friends have also stopped knocking theirs. Or to drop the metaphor, national resources should be left to where they enjoy the highest rate of return, even if this leads to loud protests from companies that have been used to being feather-bedded. The argument that others will export weapons if Britain desists is a dangerous defense for any aspect of the arms trade. The very same argument was used to defend the slave trade in the 18th century and the opium trade to China in the 19th century. Finally, I come to a question that I am often asked by friends in Whitehall. What additional measures would you like the British government to take in addition to what it is already doing? Those who know more about the details of the arms trade than I do are best placed to advise here. But let me end with a few specifics nevertheless. One of the greatest safeguards against the irresponsible grant of licenses for arms exports is the ability of the Department for International Development, Clare Schultz Department, to object to arms contracts on the basis that they are harmful to the recipient country's development. Unfortunately, it can only object like this on a case-by-case basis. It is often difficult to argue that one limited delivery would have much impact. If the department were able to take a cumulative view of all the licenses requested by or granted to a particular country, this would be a great step forward. Secondly, greater transparency. Despite the improved report on strategic exports, the criteria for approving them are still not quite clear. We need a list covering military aircraft and dual-use products as well as arms, of countries to which complete bans apply, ones where there are no restrictions, and intermediate cases. In these last, we need a clear statement for criteria covering the quantities and kind of arms which might be allowed. Thirdly, and this comes from someone who was once in charge of military procurement for the Defense Department, arms sales should only be permitted to actual or potential allies. If you regard Saudi Arabia in that category, perhaps you... Yes, exactly. He was regarded as one against Iran, and Iran was previously regarded as one, so it can go on. Now, fourthly, end subsidies, full stop. Absolutely no ECDD export for arms exports of any kind. even permitted arms exports in uncontroversial cases should have to pay their way. Fifthly, there should be an official audit of the cost and benefits of all UK arms sales. This might well be carried out by the National Audit Office that Gordon Brown likes so much. Sixth, the UK should use its influence on international aid organisations, including the IMF, the World Bank, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and other regional banks, in the following ways. Take a much stricter line on excessive spending on military hardware at the expense of genuine development. To do this, these agencies would have to return to their original functions and not become arms of US or NATO diplomacy. Then, we should insist on enforcement of a clampdown on small arms exports, other than in very restricted and permitted categories, as a condition for receiving any aid at all. I mean, aid is no use if it is simply diverted to the build up a military and industrial complex much larger than the country's legitimate defence needs. Seven, the government should at long last accept the recommendations of its own advisor, NERA, that the ECGD should have to earn the normal real rate of return on capital, the one applicable to other public investments. These steps might seem technical and modest, but if all were carried out effectively, they would lead to a gradual revolution in arms policy. Now, dare I mention the eighth on my list, the abolition of ECGD itself. This might now appear far-fetched and utopian, but would be less so if the other steps were taken first. Now, I was tempted to conclude with some resounding moral statement, which would not be too difficult. You remember from the chairman's introduction that one of my books is called Essays, Moral, Political and Economic. But I think the most important thing to do is to take this exhortation for granted and to keep going in the right direction in the face of every kind of interest group and prejudiced viewpoint. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sir Samuel, very much indeed for giving us such an interesting and thought-provoking lecture, covering such a wide range of issues, and also for sticking to time, incidentally, as well. We've got about 40 minutes now for questions and discussion points. I'll take a few questions at a time from around the hall. We've got two roving microphones, one upstairs and one downstairs. If you could give your name and where you're from before you ask your question, that would be great. Thanks very much. I saw the lady up there with the hat on. Sorry, the mic is a rather long way away. Perhaps we'll just take this lady downstairs first of all, and we'll come to you in just a moment.
We're talking here about subsidising a deadly plague. Surely we should look as a nation quite carefully at the sort of things that we are prepared to subsidise, what we would like to subsidise, what we would like to see in our, not only our economic life, but our life. There is also life outside economics.
Surely not.
Be
Thank you, lady down here.
Thanks, Juliana Johan. I'm a PhD student of international relations. I have three questions. I happen to live in the Middle East, actually in the Gulf, and you mentioned Alia Mama Project. And, well, you mentioned all these leaders, getting all this money into weapons. But as far as my experience, in the Gulf, many leaders sometimes, they got phone calls from embassies from the U.S. or from the U.K. telling, if you don't buy from us, we take off our troops from here. You know, it's not only weapons, it's any kind of imports. So considering all this and considering this country's stance towards the Iraqi issue, since the end of the Gulf War, we see all the GCC weapons procurement pretty much in the UK and the States, and this huge amount of purchases. So I wanted to hear your opinion as this failed policy pursued by this foreign policy, this country here, of sanctions in Iraq that only empowers Saddam Hussein even more and not those who could threaten to overcome him, and ensure that the GCC countries, they would keep buying weapons from here, huge profits. So I wonder if this is just a mess and just kind of total lack of control and they don't know what to do as a face saving, or if it has to do with some lobby from weapons here. Okay, the second question is like more philosophical or psychological. Once I heard a guy telling me that when UK arms exported, when he signed the deal, he was shivering with pleasure, and I thought, oh, it must be because of this huge amount of money involved. And then the guy said, no, it's just like a toy, like a boy game, like he got the deal against the competitors, so it's kind of this kind of pleasure out of it, not knowing what it is to live in a post-war country and seeing what these things do. So sometimes I get really shocked when I hear these things, and also in this country, like, people love these technological things and they go to the bookshops and they go and buy these war books and they read in these things. So how can you tackle when they're so widespread in the culture, this love for weapons? And the final one is this NATO. You mentioned that, okay, NATO can keep, specializing and buying. So NATO was supposed to be against the communist enemy, and now that it's gone, it seems that, I don't know, the rogue states of concern is the new fashion. But considering that this state of concerns, they have been into conflict mainly because misery and the development, and pretty much they are ex-colonies, so I don't see any morality in NATO to keep arming against third world countries or South, so I wish you could comment on that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll just take those questions to start off with. Can I just also remind you to please keep the questions quite short and say who you are before you start your question.
I didn't mind comments if people want to make them, but I know you need to get through. Now, the first questioner... Sorry. The first questioner pointed out quite rightly that there was a life outside economics. The reason... Sorry, the mic doesn't...
Tilt it downwards.
I was using the other microphone, which doesn't seem to be working, but I think this one is. The reason why I spent a lot of time on the economics of the arms trade is that there are so many people who say this is regrettable, but we need it. In fact, I was arguing with a Scottish trade unionist in a radio discussion at lunch today, and he said that in an ideal world, I'd rather be making something else. But he seemed to, he didn't really think that, but what he believed in his government intervention and support for everything, including arms, that we can't all subsidize each other in everything we do. Now, when the same lady said that we can't all be net exporters, well then, so far from being anti-economics, she should be giving the first year lectures to the economic students and the final year lectures as well, because in between they forget that we can't all be net exporters. And I'm tempted to give an analysis of the effects of every country subsidizing its own exports. I think in the first place you get what are called economic rents for certain producers. Eventually, the main effect is just a distortion of the country's structure of industry. Then I also liked her idea that arms should be given away, for that if those people in the Ministry of Defence and the Foreign Office who think it very important to arm Saudi Arabia, then they should give the arms away. It would be very interesting to see if British Aerospace continues to lobby for their sales then. Another speaker mentioned that if you don't, people in the Middle East are told, if you don't buy from us, we will take our troops away. Now, maybe this would achieve two goals, that we would take troops away from supporting dubious regimes, and we would stop subsidizing arms sales to them. Now, are these activities the results of lobbying? And the answer is, and how? And the large arms exporters have the advantage they are very concentrated. People from one or two aircraft companies can easily gain the ear of Downing Street. And they are very, very good at mobilizing the unions behind them and coming in, and they do a lot of research into which constituencies might be involved if some military aircraft are cancelled. Now, the final story about the childish pleasure of an arms salesman of doing a deal, well, I don't think even in the London School of Economics we can really change human nature, at least quickly. But at least we needn't subsidize and cheerlead the worst aspects of it. I'm sorry to use the word cheerlead. I couldn't think of anything better in the time available. But if these people were not placed on the pedestal, they weren't made national heroes, and they weren't given Queen's Award for exports, we'd be a step forward. And now, another speaker also made a case against NATO. Now, I don't want, I mean, there are times and opportunities of arguing whether NATO has outlived, or arguing whether NATO has outlived its functions, or what functions it should still have. My main point is that even if you believe in NATO, and on balance I do, although not necessarily for its present functions, it does make, if you believe in having any alliances or any arms industries, it surely makes sense to specialise rather than to be self-sufficient. And that's as far as I wanted to go this evening.
Thank you. Right, there's a man over there, and front in the green jacket.
Yes. The brown jacket is straight from the economics faculties. I'd like to hear from him.
Got it?
Yep, you're right by him.
Jim Addington, Chair of Action for UN Renewal. I'd like to congratulate Sir Samuel on, first of all, demolishing the case for arms exports, secondly, for arms export subsidies. I'd just like to relate a very, very short story, and that is before the Kosovo War, the Royal United Services Institute, which represented the armed forces in Whitehall, put on a big conference. They had several hundred people, including 700 press and ambassadors from everywhere, and they, of course, discussed the impending the war. This was paid for by the British arms manufacturers. In fact, the director of the United Services Institute said, without their help, we couldn't have put this on. And I'm sure you join me in thinking that this shows another example of the incestuous relationship between the military, the industry, and governments. Is there any way in which we can break that logjam? Because I feel myself that might be the biggest contribution we could possibly make.
Martin Shell. the Fellowship Party would gladly take up this policy. It's a pity they can't have a seat. Abbott and Costello did a routine. Look at all the men you're put out of work if you don't buy your can of beans. That is, Costello was going to save America by buying a can of beans. And they were serious. That it wasn't a joke, because it was a war effort, Phil. And the question I would like to ask, though, is why do people fight? What's it supposed to achieve?
That's a very good question. We'll just quickly take the man in the blue behind you, or the mic. There are lots of questions, and we'll take another round in a moment.
Stanley Dent, ex-services campaign for nuclear disarmament. My main interest is what, in fact, we can actually do about fighting against the struggling against the arms trade. And in fact, my own conclusion is that I have spent some 40 or 50 years looking in the wrong direction here. It seems to me now, and has been growing upon me steadily over the past year or two, that our efforts, all of us, to campaign against the establishment directly has no chance. We've proved it over the years. We've got nowhere. And we've got to start putting our efforts directly into establishing ourselves with those people who are still at school in the upper forms and still at university before they in their first years, because they're the people who who've got open minds still and who can be actually interested in the future, and who are themselves indeed, we find among them the greatest degree, a far greater degree of idealism and of willingness to listen and willingness to actually ask detailed questions than those who throw things on one side and say you can't do this.
Thank you. And we'll just get this man over here and then we'll handle the panel with a fresh round.
My name's John Fender. I'm a professor of economics at Birmingham University. Could I say two things? First of all, you referred to the economics faculty and you thought they might learn something if they came to this lecture. I think that might well be true. But of academic economists, perhaps I could say, well, I can't speak for all of them, but I think most of them would recognise the arguments you discussed and so effectively demolished as, you know, grossly fallacious. I'm aware of any academic economists who would support these arguments, and these arguments don't come from us, they come rather from apologists for the arms trade. So although academic economists may be guilty of many things, I don't think they're guilty of providing arguments to support the arms trade. And secondly, you mentioned one argument that's sometimes given, that we don't sell them arms, somebody else will. I think another argument that can be made against that is that if some other country buys arms for us, then it's presumably because we're offering a better deal, either a better price or superior quality or whatever, so that if we didn't sell those arms to them and they had to go elsewhere, they would be worse off. So we would be imposing a cost on them. So even though that might be correct, even though if they don't buy the arms from us, they'll buy them from somebody else, that would still be a good reason for not selling the arms to them.
Thank you.
Well, I'll deal with the last question first. I mean, it's a very much question with which I sympathise. I was only teasing if I said that academic economists might learn something. What I really meant was that sometimes both academics and their students get so lost in the detail and in the applications that they sometimes lose track of a few basic principles, and they could be reminded of them. But the people who try to find second and third order arguments for arms sales are not academic economists, but they're sometimes their pupils. They are people, economists in government departments, and they're very nice people. They write to me and say, well, you're not going to abolish the export drive, you're not going to abolish the arms trade, you're not even going to limit it to the one or two cases where we might really improve the terms of trade, but assuming it all exists, I have this paper which suggests a few improvements. Well, no doubt this sort of second best activity is a good deal better than nothing, but they occasionally need to stand back. and ask what they're doing. If they all had private incomes, some of them might leave their government departments, and that would be to the general good. Now, I come quickly to the other questions. The person who was speaking about exhibiting weapons before Kosovo, I wonder whether he was talking about the Farnborough Air Show. Now, that's a disgrace. Farnborough Air Show is an occasion when not merely people who might remotely be enemies in the future, but people from all sorts of places in the Balkans and the Middle East come along. And unless we're at this moment engaged in the war against them, or unless there is something that, like the coup in Pakistan, which New Labour has decided to condemn, but mostly they are very obvious potential enemies. But again, on the argument if we don't sell them, the French, well, it's not even that, it's schoolboy type air enthusiasts who like to talk about the Farnborough Air Show. Now, if you could only stop the Financial Times from reporting it, that would be a great step forward. I have tried, but perhaps... but perhaps feebly. And now, how to get... I may have overlooked a question or... not be able to read my handwriting. How do you get a case across? I agree you should concentrate on one young people, but however strongly we believe in something, we cannot use the schools or the universities for indoctrination. They've got to be exposed. Sorry, I keep on moving away from the microphone. They've got to be exposed to people from various points of view. In fact, I think it would be very much better if the people who believe in arms sales actually spoke up and made their case, because my normal experience at meetings like this is that a few people do come along from the arms producing companies. They sit silently and they make notes and they never contribute to the discussion. I think they should be forced to, so their arguments can be judged. After all, if quite young people here do not mind making a fool of themselves, why shouldn't the middle-aged people who sell arms do the same? And maybe they will persuade all of us. Who knows? And one other thing before people start getting too pessimistic and saying nothing has been achieved, something has been achieved. There are various international agreements which are partly observed, at least. There is the European Union Export Convention relating to arms. There are various international agreements. There are the agreements against nuclear proliferation. There are even that we should not despise the rules of the Berne Credit Union, which limit export credit subsidies. Nor should we underrate what has happened, and there could be a backlash against this, that the government has tightened up on the criteria. Although its policies are not completely transparent, it does have a very thick annual white paper on defence export sales, so-called defence export sales, which we never had before. So don't despair about everything because you haven't achieved it all in one day. I mean, I think that it would help if Robin Cook were cheered at least for his efforts to achieve a foreign policy with an ethical element, even though he falls short of the aim, and not sneered at whenever he opens his mouth.
Thank you. Well, if there are any arms producers here, then please make themselves
known. Or even middle-of-the-road people who disagree.
Okay, there's...
Somebody who has shares in British Aerospace.
There's someone up there with the mic, and then I'd like to go to the man back there. Then there's somebody right up front, upstairs. There's Sam in the towards the right-hand side here. And then someone else over there. Okay, so we'll start off with you with the mic.
Well, I'm one of those nice people from Whitehall. My name is Neil Davis. I'm the Senior Economic Advisor at the Ministry of Defence.
Yes. So it's sometimes a bit difficult to remember, sorry.
Pause for the... Yes, it's... I'm not quite sure how I got the invitation, but I was very pleased to receive the invitation. Some of your agenda, you might be pleased to hear, actually is going to be progressed quite soon. You mentioned wanting to see a cost-benefit analysis of defence exports, and I, together with some academic defence economists, will be producing something, building on and responding to the work that you referred to by Dr. Martin at York. And you may be pleased to know that the NERA report's also not been buried. Work is going on in ECGD to quantify the notional interest cost as part of work to develop the ECGD operating on a trading fund basis. The acid test and the key to the argument really does depend upon balance between the cost of support, mod support, primarily through DSO, and the ECGD support balanced against the contribution that defence exports make to defraying the overhead cost that would otherwise fall to the MOD. Getting a handle on all of these things is not easy, but the work that we will be publishing will set out why we believe that the net balance is actually a gain to government, not a subsidy. And I look forward, when we publish, which I hope will be in early May, to your comments on our paper and on the underlying analytical support. The rest of the arguments really do fall by the wayside. The points that you make about the adjustment costs, the fallacy of lump of labour, almost a sort of a straw man argument. The key is, are these activities overall subsidised, in which case one balances a one-off adjustment cost against a continuing cost of subsidy. If they are not subsidised but actually make a net benefit, then the economic argument becomes one of why incur both a one-off adjustment cost and an ongoing net cost to government, primarily as a customer. And that's the economic proposition that I recognise has to be set against a whole lot of wider political and moral considerations, which in my position I prefer not to make any comment on, but recognise that in any overall balance, the economics has to be traded against wider considerations. And the size of the industry, the size of the adjustment that would now be incurred, you are quite right, is pretty small compared to the scale of adjustment that we've seen when coal mines closed, when steel factories closed. But the key is the point about subsidy. And there, I believe that you are not correct. Thank you.
Thank you. No, yes, the man
there
at the back.
My first question is, it's George, General, how can the tension between the WTO regimes and the biosafety protocol and the arms control regime be well addressed, be best addressed? My second question is, when you were Trade Commissioner, did you have to deal with those issues? What was your stand against the other parties?
Thank you. Then the man up there in the white shirt.
Okay, my name is David Coburn. I am no longer an arms manufacturer. I spent 20 years up until 1997 being involved in the defence electronics industry. I have subsequently gone off and studied peace and I'm now working for that. I thought I was working for peace before. Sir Samuel, your analysis was intriguing, but is not one I recognise. Speaking from somebody who knows the defence industry from the inside, it was, dare I say it, a little naive. It seems to me to come down to a question of outsourcing. Do we as a country, if we believe in military defence and therefore having armaments, want to acquire those from within our country or outside? Let me tell you about a couple of contracts I worked on. This was in the days when Maggie Thatcher was in power. The contracts were worded such that the initial production costs and development were at a fixed cost. Any additional orders, which were export, were at a much higher cost. The companies had to bid on the basis that on the initial production and UK market, you made a loss. But you made your profit by exporting. If you didn't export, which you needed government support, you lost your contract to the Americans or the French or the Germans or somebody else. So it's a question of outsourcing and markets and market forces. Do you want military production in this country in a or do you want to rely on the Americans, the French, the Germans, the South Africans and the Israelis? Or perhaps even the Saudis in time to come? Why shouldn't other countries have arms? If we believe in arms as a way to security, surely it's perfectly legitimate for other countries to have arms as well, and of the same sort of nature. And they have some choices to get those. They can buy them from us, which means exports. They can buy them from somebody else, let's say the Americans, the Chinese, the Russians, and that means exports from them. They can make them in-house, which for countries like Sri Lanka and India means spending vast amounts of their national precious GDP on developing arms industries and increasing the world supply of arms. Or they can choose not to have arms. So perhaps it's not just a question that if we export, we are doing them harm, perhaps we're doing them good, by not taking up more of their precious natural resources without their own indigenous arms industry. Now, most of that I disagree with, but the question I would put to you is, can you give us the positives and the negatives of what it means to outsource our arms industry, as would, I believe, inevitably happen, to, for example, the US, France, Germany, South Africa or Israel in times of national crisis and war? Let me put my last position. I'm a pacifist. I don't believe in the arms trade anymore. But for those who do, somebody needs to produce arms if you believe in defence. And you either get them from in-house, and that may mean putting subsidies in, subsidies for indigenous manufacture or hidden subsidies of exports, or you outsource. And in time of war, is outsourcing a good idea?
Thank you. Then Sam down here, Martin, just there.
Sam Perlo Freeman. Sam Perlo Freeman, cat activist in various respects, and defence economics student. I found your argument and the demolition of the economic arguments for the arms trade pretty convincing, as you probably expect. I'm conscious that CAT as an organisation does like to reach out to all sorts of groups, including workers in the arms industry, that we'll often have people at the factory gates handing out leaflets, engaging the workers in conversation. I say, sort of putting myself in the shoes of people like that, perhaps your arguments wouldn't sound so convincing. If I was a trade union rep at one of these arms factories or a 50-year-old arms worker with fairly specialised skills, then this argument, oh, well, it's only 0.5% of the UK job market, it's only 30,000, it's an easy adjustment. Well, half of those workers would find jobs within the next 2 years, and half won't. I might find that pretty cold comfort. I mean, of course, we can say, yeah, there's a few losers, but they're a small minority, and most of us are gainers. But what arguments, if we don't want to do that, if we are wanting to reach out to people who are in the arms industry, is there any way that these arguments can apply to people who might be directly and personally affected? Have we got an alternative way to direct their efforts and skills into alternative and more beneficial sources of labour and employment?
I've got quite a lot on my plate here already. I was delighted to hear our friend from the Ministry of Defence. I was delighted to hear our friend from the Ministry of Defence say that they are going to produce a paper on the costs and benefits of arms exports. I wish they had done so 50 years ago. It's only through organisations like this and other ones, and pressure from MPs as well, that the government has got this far. I mean, if these estimates had been around 20 or 30 years ago, they could have been compared with estimates from independent economists. And of course, this wouldn't establish the moral case, but at least we would know what we are arguing about. I'd say something else too, that even if you do establish some case, it would be of the second order of smalls, if I can address a few numerous people. It would be a second order of smalls. Now, the ministers and businessmen, politicians who read these things, they don't think in terms of 0.01% of the national income, whatever you might manage to establish. They think there's going to be mass unemployment and a vast loss of exports and terrible consequences of the British economy. So they read the bottom line, saying on balance justified, on balance some savings are made, and they don't see how trivial it all is. I mean, I don't think that the budgetary costs are enormous, but given that they are probably adverse, although I await your report, the economic costs of doing, either are no economic costs of doing the right thing, or they might even be beneficial. Now, I was very amused by the second question about what I thought when I was Trade Commissioner. I would have to have telepathy to know that, because I was never Trade Commissioner. And what is the biblical saying? I am not my brother's keeper. But I'm flattered that somebody thinks I was. Now, a very eloquent case was made for the military industrial base by somebody who afterwards announced that he was converted to pacifism. I merely said I was pacific. But it's interesting how extremes touch. You either go to one extreme or you support everything wrong that now goes on. Now, the military industrial base, which I should have perhaps made more of, is a, whenever people use that expression, not sure that you did, but when people do, you know where they're coming from. The military industrial base goes back about 100 years to the case of dreadnoughts, the time of dreadnoughts before World War I. The point of it then was, and I know a little bit of the history of this, the point of it then was that the government didn't know whether it was going to be fighting Germany in alliance with France, or fighting France in alliance with Germany, or in some other way. And therefore, if you believed in this whole ridiculous balance of power game, there was some point in aiming for self-sufficiency. But, I mean, do you really think the next war is going to be because Israel or Kuwait or Jordan is attacking the UK? If there is to be, if there is a case for a large military structure, it is surely in cooperation with Western Europe and the United States. I mean, not even the people in Defense Department think that we're going to fight on alone with another Dunkirk. But even in the time of Dunkirk, we would never have got through without imports of military and other equipment from the United States. Now, finally, what would I say to the worker at the factory gate? Well, fortunately, I live in a rather rarefied atmosphere. Also, I believe in division of labour. I would send you to the factory gate. But how would you have justified the introduction of a new technology to printers, some of whom are now driving taxis and doing all sorts of things? The answer is, you can't. There is no way you can make a case that somebody is going to lose, however generous the compensation. But seriously, the way I would approach it is looking at existing efforts for compensation and retraining for people who lose jobs. I mean, you only have to listen to a Gordon Brown speech to hear what they are, and although they're hyped up, they're not completely fictitious. There is unemployment pay, whatever it's now called. There are various social security benefits which are topped up rightly for people with families. There is retraining, and then when there is a large loss of jobs, or even an imagined large loss of jobs, as in the countryside now, you get special government programs. Now, when there is a geographically concentrated loss, then there is a case for some special effort, such as sending somebody down to attract employers and giving slightly larger subsidies. But I do, in the last resort, believe in the market economy. That is, the consumer should choose. And I don't think that you can keep people where they are indefinitely. And in the end, they have to find out what are the non-subsidized other industries where they can find employment. And I think history shows there always are.
Thank you very much indeed. We're right out of time. Can you take a couple more questions? Or?
Yes, if you let me, Joan.
Thank you very much. Okay, there's a man towards the back in blue who's been waiting quite a long time. Then there's somebody up there in the green jumper and glasses next. And I think just one more. Can I just see the hands again? The lady in the blue, greenish cardigan. Yes, you, third. And I think we'll have to leave it at that. I'm sorry for those who haven't.
My name's Alex, and I've never been to university ever, apart from a three-month stint that failed. I'm also 27. And there's two things. I think the one thing that props up exports in terms of basically what we've been talking about is not subsidies or funding, things like that, is apathy. That's the biggest prop that anything like that has, because if more people actually cared about it, people that aren't in the halls of academia, people that don't read The Guardian and so on, then basically politicians would realise they needed to win votes, and then that would be a big sort of change that would happen. The other thing is that a guy just over there made the point about how do you feel going to tell somebody at a factory that they're going to lose their job as a result of decreased subsidies or whatever. How would you rather go and tell somebody that they've lost their job and they'll be unemployed in the short term, may or may not get a job but will still have benefits, or would you rather go to and explain to a family in a country that had just been, well, basically murdered, or I don't know, explain why somebody's son has been shot through a gun that you've been made? It's a sort of reasonably simple choice, I think.
Thank you. Then the gentleman up there.
Frank Jackson, World Disarmament Campaign. I'm inspired to make a comment by a friend from the MOD and the ex-arms industry gentleman over there, who's now a convert. The references have been to defence and security. Now, the fact is that there are more arms in the world today than there have ever been before. Everything from pistols to nuclear weapons. The current expenditure, I believe, total world expenditure, is of the order of $800 billion annually. Now, has this actually given anybody in the world more security? I think the answer to that is clearly no. So, therefore, thanks for the applause, but let's get on with the point. surely, over and above all the detailed analytical arguments presented by Sir Samuel, we can look at this much wider position and say quite clearly that the policies, whatever the details are concerned, they simply are not working, and the only sensible policy for the human species as a whole is to try to stop not just the arms trade, but the whole business of production of armaments. And one more rather fundamental point, which I think is very often missed, in fact it's hardly ever realised, and that is that people, governments, the military and so on, argue for their expenditure on armaments in the name of defence and security. But the one of the fundamental reasons for the existence of armed forces, probably in most cases the most fundamental, is that the possession of armed forces is the ultimate guarantor of the state itself, of the state mechanism itself, not against external enemies but against internal ones. And therefore that is another very fundamental reason why we should reject the whole argument about the need for this weapon, that weapon, or the other weapon. And incidentally, I also worked in the electronics industry with and previously the aircraft industry, with some bits and pieces of my work associated with military, but on the whole I try to be on the peaceful activity side. Don't say I always succeed, but I do recognise the difficulties for workers inside the industry.
Thank you. And the lady in the green cardigan just there, the mic's just behind you.
Yes, my name is Anya, ordinary person, very ordinary. And I keep wondering here, listening to all this, that why cannot we try to get these governments who are trading with arms and taken to the courts and accuse them of murder?
Can you repeat that last point, please?
Accuse them of murder, murdering people, because I hear a lot of peace people are taken to the court and prisons and that. Why can't we take governments? What change?
Thank you.
Is there any chance of that?
Thanks.
Well, again, I'll deal with the last point first. I wouldn't be too pessimistic. There is something called the International War Crimes Court, which has just been set up quite recently. There is a campaign going on to send ex-President Milosevic to this court. One or two people have already given themselves up or been sent there by the republics of former Yugoslavia. So there is something to press on with. And I think if they are really brought to justice, their sentences will be a good deal more severe than that inflicted on peace campaigners who clash with the police. The arguments I always find most difficult to answer is how would you put this over to a large audience? How would you have a popular campaign? Well, you really want somebody from one of the tabloids on this. And I'm invited to dinner to discuss all this in a few weeks' time, I always emphasize that I am not the Countess of Wessex. I am not. I'm better looking than she is, but I'm not a PR expert. But somebody in the middle here would be much better at it than I am, because he would say to somebody outside a factory gate in Glasgow, Do you realise that because of your reluctance to retrain or to retire early or anything like that, do you realise where your arms have gone? Now, if he's well briefed by his company, he'll say, well, if mine don't go, somebody else's will. That is not an argument that a thug in a street fight could get away with. That does occur to me. People also talk about lack of popular campaigns, but John Pilger, whom I don't agree with on everything, but he tries in a much more popular way than I ever could in the press and in television programs to put these points across. And actually, television is much abused, but if you had had television in the Boer War, in the Crimean War, for instance, I think these wars would have come to an end much earlier. And the Vietnam, anti-Vietnam movement in the United States had a great deal to do with what was seen on television. And I think when you show people being blown to pieces with landmines, which are made either in Britain as they were before or by Britain's allies, then it does have an impact. But you have to proceed slowly. Now, I would be very willing, although it's not my profession, I'd be very willing to give a talk against arms trade, against militarist foreign policies, against the phony security provided by so-called alliances, but I was asked to do something else. I was asked to try to explain why the British economy would not come to an end if we had a rather more effective ethical foreign policy than we have at the moment. And I have done my best to do that. Now, of course, small arms provide no security. You're not going to stop it, but you can do something. For instance, in all the negotiations about loans to Russia, for instance, which in the IMF and elsewhere, I have never seen any conditions made relating to the sale of small arms. And many of these Kalashnikovs come from that part of the world. And I've never seen any conditions put on here. And that's why I said it's very important that these aid organizations should go back to their professed functions and stop being arms of American diplomacy. So there is quite a lot that could be done at the margin. Now, one question which I realize I didn't tackle because I couldn't, was why do people fight? Now, if we're going to find any answer, it's going to be, in my biased view, from the study of evolutionary psychology. And there is a center for this, a center for philosophy, for the study of the philosophy of the social and physical sciences, just a part of the LSE and around the corner from here, does have an important interest in evolutionary psychology. So far, the efforts have been mainly into the natural division between men and women, and perhaps why they fight each other. But a start on this, and I'm very much in other people's territory here, but the start on this might be that there is it must have its origins in the rivalry of males to plant their sperms into as many eggs as possible. Now, there is physical limits to how this can be done, who can do this in a small tribe. And this may have something to do with the roots of the fighting spirit. But what is even more difficult to explain is the combination of genuine altruism, which does take place within small groups, with absolute viciousness towards outsiders, towards people outside these groups. And whoever could tackle this and find a way of either living with it or reducing it, even if it means experiments which some people in this room might not like, would deserve Nobel Prizes in all the social and natural sciences many times over. Thank you.
Well, that's a very tantalising and fascinating note on which to leave it, but we're right out of time, so we will have to leave it there. But thank you all very much for coming and for your very penetrating points and questions. I think we had a very interesting and far-reaching debate. I know I've enjoyed it greatly. You can receive a copy of the lecture by filling in the form at the back of the programme. And for those of you who don't know about the Campaign Against Arms Trade, I'd urge you to fill that in, and it will be collected as you leave the hall. Many thanks to those from the CAT office, staff and volunteers, and without whom this evening would not have been possible. And finally, but not least, on behalf of CAT and everybody here, I'd like to thank Sir Samuel Britton very much for being with us this evening and giving us such a stimulating and comprehensive lecture and answering all the questions with such clarity and candour. Sir Samuel, you've given us a wonderful evening, and we look forward to continuing the debate with you in the future. Thank you again.